Hello, thank you for joining me on Conversations with Catalysts. Please find my links anytime at jeremywest.net. Right now, I am offering a free session with me to explore whether you want to do an 8-week mindfulness course, which is pay what you want or just pay it forward. So check out jeremywest.net for that. Also, pay what you want slash pay it forward. Therapy sessions. If there's anything you're working on that you would like to try hypnotherapy on.
Today, I have with me Quincy Worf. Welcome to the podcast, Quincy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Before we really get started, can I just have you tell us a little bit about who is Quincy Worf and how did you come to the world of coaching?
Oh my, I came to the world of coaching totally by accident, but I've been doing it for the last 20 plus years, and I specialize in a couple of areas. I do a lot of love and relationship and dating coaching. I do a lot of life and executive type coaching, but I also do addiction intervention and recovery coaching as well. And, I've always been one of those kind of people who, feel like everything kind of mixes into everything. And so just because that's the starting point of where we may get together, it doesn't mean that that's where it stays all the time.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So you ended up in the world of coaching a little bit by accident. Tell me a little bit about that story.
It was something that I was doing in the beginning as, just kind of like as on a volunteer thing. Like it was something I would help people out with here and there once in a while. And then it became something that people started referring other people to, or they would hear me speak and they would say, oh, my God, could you please help me with this? And so it kind of just evolved naturally into what it was supposed to become, to the point where it became a full-fledged like business,
Were you a speaker, a public speaker already before you became a coach?
Yeah, actually, I was working as a I did a lot of public speaking for, all different kinds of topics. And, I guess that's kind of where people would hear me and they would hear my ideas and what was going on with me. And they'd be like, oh, my God, that makes perfect sense, And so the coaching thing just kind of came naturally. Like I was really, doing the speaking thing and thinking the speaking thing was really what I wanted to do. But I've actually really enjoyed both of those things,
So back up a little bit. How did you end up as a speaker?
How did I end up as a speaker? Well, I started speaking in college on different topics of mostly about addiction, mostly about, mental health stuff. And it was all kind of like volunteer stuff that people would say, oh, please go tell your story. And I was like, okay, I'll tell my story if that's what you want to hear. And I would just go and I would tell my story and about, growing up in Hollywood and, being a teenage alcoholic and, growing up in the music business and having this, what sounded like it should have been a, wild and crazy life to it turning into a complete nightmare and being, super dangerous and putting me in a lot of situations that, you wouldn't want your 15, 16, 17-year-old child to go through, and then spending, getting sober and spending, the rest of my life being sober and what that's looked like and all the trials and tribulations of learning how to find new coping mechanisms besides things that you can become addicted to, because you can get addicted to anything, right? If you have that type of personality and anything that makes you feel good, that you want to do on a regular basis to avoid dealing with what you don't want to deal with is destructive behavior in a lot of ways.
Okay, so can you tell us a little bit more about growing up in Hollywood?
Sure. I mean, I come from old Hollywood royalty, as they used to call it. My grandfather was an actor and a writer and a director, and he was, on the stage and on a whole bunch of movies and directed a whole bunch of TV shows. And so, my dad's family all came from that. And so my father, he wasn't an actor, but he was an artist, and he ended up working in the music business my whole life and designing album covers, which most people don't know what those are. right? Pretty funny. Like, you know, you got to go Google that and figure out what it is. But so he designed album covers. So it was just, we had a very interesting lifestyle. There was a lot of really interesting people in my house growing up. Like there were a lot of, you know, drunk, naked musicians at my house, which again, I didn't know that wasn't normal. I thought everybody had that at their house, but apparently not so much. So I was just around a lot of people. And then, you know, being in the club scene and being, you know, just living in Los Angeles and living in Hollywood, you know, during the 80s, you know, it was a fun place to be at the time.
But then it became a bit messy.
Oh yeah, very, very messy, very quickly. You know, and that's like, it was a different time. My parents were, you know, that generation was a lot more hands-off than this generation is with their kids. And it wasn't that they ignored us, but we had a lot more autonomy and a lot more freedom. And I had a little, probably too much freedom. And, you know, my mom and my dad ended up going through a horrible, nasty divorce. And during that whole time, you know, neither one of them were really paying attention to what I was doing. And I was out clubbing every night and drinking and doing drugs and hanging out with boys and having a good old time. But it ended up getting pretty dangerous for me. And I was lucky that, you know, I didn't get into more scrapes than I did.
So how did the change start to happen for you?
You know, it's funny because people always say, you got to wait for an addict to hit bottom. And, you know, everybody's bottom looks different when it comes to dealing with drugs and alcohol, especially, or any addiction. Like, you know, whenever you decide to stop digging, that's your bottom. And, you know, for me, it would take a lot of demoralization, pain behind demoralization. And, you know, there were lots of times when I would drink and get drunk and, you know, things would happen to me that I had no control over them happening. You know, I would be with people who I thought were safe, who really weren't safe. And because I was loaded, could not defend myself, whether it was a sexual assault or being in a place that I shouldn't have been in or whatever it was, or things that were happening around me that I had no control over. And, you know, one of the last times I drank, I was in a situation where this guy who I thought I was friends with, I thought he was like being my protector this one particular night. I was so drunk and so out of my mind. And it turned out he was just, you know, moving me away from the regular room so that he could have his way with me. And I was so paralyzed because I was so drunk that I couldn't even stop him from doing it. And, you know, I was mostly in a blackout. So there's a lot of it I don't remember, but those were the kinds of things that were happening to me. And it was a price in the beginning that I was willing to pay for drugs and alcohol because, you know, being that drunk, you don't feel anything. You don't remember anything. You don't care about anything. And that was kind of what I was going for, but it was getting harder and harder for me to not remember and harder for me to make the shame go away. And I finally just hit a wall where I was like, you know what? I can't do this anymore. I can't stay drunk long enough to not feel like, you know, the world's biggest piece of shit. And I can't stay sober long enough to feel okay on this planet. And I didn't know what to do, you know? And as luck would have it, I ended up getting sober and running into a whole bunch of other people that were sober, and my life changed forever. So it was good.
So were you able to just quit cold turkey on your own, or how did you go about that?
I mean, I did. Like, I remember detoxing in my room by myself for a couple of days. I mean, a long time ago, before there were rehabs, it was, you know, like, I've been sober since 1988. So rehabs were not all the rage that they are now. I mean, now there's one on every street corner, but, you know, back in those days, you just shook it out. And I did. Like, I just sweated and had a headache and slept and was miserable for a couple of days. And I was lucky. I wasn't nearly as saturated as I could have been. Like, you know, there's detoxing off of alcohol is really dangerous. It can actually kill you. Between that and benzos, those are the only two detoxes that can really, really hurt you. The others will make you wish you were dead, but won't necessarily kill you. But detoxing off alcohol is really dangerous. And I was lucky that I wasn't so saturated that I ended up having like seizures or, you know, going into, you know, any kind of other type of physical reaction. I was just miserable for 4 days and then finally, you know, came out of it.
So do you remember when you were that miserable for 4 days. How you stopped yourself from drinking again?
You know, most of it had to do with, you know, being, you know, I ran into a bunch of people in 12-step programs, and I ended up going to a 12-step program, which was great and worked for me perfectly. And that was a lot of it. But a lot of it also was really getting clarity on the fact that that wasn't an option for me anymore. Like, me drinking and using was causing more pain than it was killing. And I really was too chicken shit to kill myself. So it was like, you better come up with something else. And, you know, and truthfully, like, because I didn't really understand what addiction was all about, I just found other things to get addicted to, whether it was, you know, boys or, you know, shopping or food or, you know, whatever it was that I, you know, was using to avoid dealing with the things that were unpleasant in my life. You know, I just kept changing one addiction to another, to another, to another, until I finally hit a wall and had to learn how to get tools, right? Which was what 12-step programs are really about, is tools. But most people don't even understand how 12-step programs work. And I didn't for a long time. Like, I didn't understand that drugs and alcohol weren't the problem. Whatever it was that I was addicted to wasn't the problem. I was the problem. Like, the way I, you know, solved problems was the problem. And the way I solved problems at the time was to not solve problems, was to pretend that they weren't happening, or to, you know, go in a different direction. I mean, addiction is all about avoidance. That's all it's really about. And, you know, it was hard for me for a long time to face the stuff that scared the crap out of me, or face the stuff that was painful, or any of that kind of stuff. And until I really learned that that stuff couldn't hurt me again, I couldn't face it. So, you know, it takes time. It takes time. People have to want to be different, and they have to want to know what makes them tick. And, you know, I just kept making the same mistakes over and over and over again. And I got sick and tired of doing that. So at some point I became willing to learn how to do it differently. And, you know, for me, pain is the great motivator, you know, and I will do anything to get out of pain, but I don't want the pain to come back. So learning how to deal with pain, how to process pain, how to process trauma, how to, you know, learn how to communicate in different ways, learn how to, you know, relate to different things, learn how to have different boundaries, have boundaries at all. Like, I had no boundaries most of my life. And then having to get boundaries was really painful and difficult. But dealing with all that stuff is, you know, what gives me today the insight that I have into people, because I've been through so many different kinds of things, and I have done such a tremendous amount of work on my own pain and my own trauma and my own, you know, deficiencies. You know, it's easy for me now to spot that stuff in people and help them get through that process as well. And, you know, it's funny, when I first started coaching people, like, I didn't really understand how much I was going to learn about the process when I started coaching people. Like, you can sit there and tell somebody, you know, everything that they need to know about themselves to be different, but really, until they start trying to help somebody else be different, they may not even understand it or really understand how to apply it.
Yeah, I saw a sign somewhere once that said, I teach what I most need to learn.
Exactly, exactly. And that's so true. It's funny. It's the best way to learn, because it becomes ingrained in you. If we could figure out how to, you know, turn the school systems into a students teaching students situation, they'd probably be a lot smarter.
Well, I won't go off on too much of a tangent, but there's a school in Sudbury, Massachusetts that works that way, but it's just called the Sudbury School. So, Quincy, what is your, now that you've dumped the negative addictions, what is your go-to when that pain surfaces now?
Well, there's a bunch of different things that I, you know what I mean? Like, the number one thing I've learned probably in the last, I don't know, couple of years, is that no matter how many tools you have, if you don't allow yourself to process the feelings that come up as a result of whatever it is that's going on with you, we call it spiritual bypassing, you won't get to where you need to get to any faster, right? Like, there's a process. There's a whole process that happens in really moving from one place to another emotionally. And you can't just will it away just because you want to. But what I've also learned is that until I've processed the feelings and until I can, you know, get to a place where I'm not as emotional about what it is that's going on, I can't really start to work on how can I look at this differently, right? So, but learning how to identify that, number one, feelings are there as red flags to tell me, number one, something's going on. Number two, you know, the only thing I can do about it is the way I'm looking at it, the way I understand it, the way I perceive it, what I've decided it means about me, all of those kinds of things. I can't do anything about what the other person has done or doing or not doing, but I can change the way that I'm looking at it or figure out what it is that I'm supposed to learn from it. And so I have a process that I've used, you know, for probably at least the last 20 something years of, you know, recognizing, number one, when I'm having feelings, because I can be really busy. Like, I'm also addicted to being busy, and I'm really good at being busy so that I don't have feelings, right? And I have to learn how to, you know, I had to learn how to recognize when I wasn't in the greatest of places, what that meant and what I needed to do with it, or else it was going to come and get me, you know? And so there's just a process. It means taking time to meditate so that I can get clear on what it is that's going on with me. It means, you know, taking time to journal on a regular basis. It means taking time to really check in with what's going on with me and having somebody say to me, you know, what is going on with you? Because I can get away from myself, no problem. I cannot answer my own questions really easily. But I have, you know, I have always had a coach, or I've had somebody that I do accountability work with, because I'm not really good at seeing myself. I'm really great at seeing you, but I'm not great at seeing myself. So I always have needed somebody to say, you know, you seem a little off. What's going on with you? I won't even notice it, but somebody outside of me will notice it before me. And that's, you know, that's so important in my life, you know?
Yeah, that's one thing my coach says, is when you're looking for a coach, make sure that they have a coach, because everyone,
because
what was it? Oh, she said that people ask her, what's it like to have all your shit together? And she's like, I don't know. Let me know if you get to that point.
That's so true. Yeah, it's not that people are, nobody's perfect, right? Nobody does this perfectly. But I really believe that if you're not still continuing to grow or still continuing to do your work, you're limited as a coach. And not only that, like, there's a level of humility that comes with being able to have somebody in your life who kind of keeps your feet on the ground and says, hey, you know, this isn't working for you. We need to look at this, you know, before you turn around and say to somebody else, hey, this isn't working for you, you know?
Yeah.
And you can only spot, you know, what you've worked on. Like, that was my biggest problem with therapy for a long time, was I would go to therapists as a kid, or as a, you know, in my 20s or whatever. And these people would have just gotten out of school or whatever, and they had like no life experience, or even if they were older, their life experience was so different than what I was going through in my life. And it was hard to have conversations with people who really could not understand what I was going through, because they had never even been through it. They'd never been around it. They'd never had any experience with it. And, you know, it's hard to help heal somebody who doesn't have that kind of base in their life, you know?
So when you would be talking to a counselor and they didn't understand what you were going through, how did that make you feel? Just kidding. So what, if you could bring more of any one thing into the world, Quincy, what would it be?
What would it be? Tolerance, you know, tolerance.
Tell me more.
I just think that I have a hard time being tolerant of my teenager, right? Because he's not doing it the way I want him to do things. Instead of being in a place of tolerance where I remember that he has a path and I've got to let him do things the way he's supposed to do things. You know, if we can't let the people in our house be different, how are we going to let people in the world be different? And, you know, it's one of those things that, like, until you have a level of tolerance for others, I don't know how much compassion you can actually have either, you know?
So you're telling me that your teenager does things in a way that it's as almost as if he doesn't have 50 years of life experience?
Oh yeah, it's quite irritating.
So frustrating.
I know. Damn child. But yeah,
I have teenagers as well.
Yeah, they are, you know, and it's funny because he's so much like I was at his age, even though like situations are different or what he's willing to tolerate is, you know, or what he's doing in his life is different. But at the same time, he's going through the same kind of life experiences that I went through at that age. And I forget what it's like to be a 17-year-old. You know, all I can see is, dude, you need to do this and you need to get it done now, you know? And, you know, he's got his own stuff going on. And it's, you know, I just have to always check myself for, you know, how tolerant am I being? Am I being tolerant of people on the freeway? Am I, you know, I just got back from, I had to go do a talk in Michigan, and, you know, traveling and watching people, you know, at the airport or being on airplanes with people is frustrating, because there are some people who travel well, and there are some people who travel like they have never been on an airplane before, you know? And it's hard. It's hard sometimes to like have patience for other people and remember that everybody here on this planet has a different level of experience, different level of, you know, education, different level of everything, you know? And so everybody has a different, you know, comes to the table in every moment differently than the person next to them. And, you know, letting people be who they are without taking them personal is probably one of the things that I help people the most with in coaching. I would have to, especially relationship coaching. Oh my God. You know, we take people, we take our partners, we take people we're interested in, you know, or people we date, all those kinds of things. We take all of that stuff so personally, like it means something bad about us. When the truth is that most of the time it means nothing about us. It's just who they are, you know? And, you know, how much freer the world would be if people, you know, could stop taking everybody so personally.
Yeah, something that I read sometime in the last few years that's really stuck with me is just assume everyone is doing the best that they can. And that does two things. Number one, you know, you are tolerant and forgive because they're doing the best they can. And number two, if their best isn't good enough for you, then maybe they shouldn't be in your life. But again, right. There's no reason to hold any grudges or anything because they were doing the best that they could.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, it's hard for a lot of people, you know?
Yeah, probably most of us. Yeah. Because we can, as you say, we can only see things from our own perspective.
Perspective.
So yep. We have all the experience we have. Yeah, we don't, and we don't know how much we're driving other people nuts by not having the experience they have. But we do know that they're driving us nuts by not having the experience we have.
Yes, that is true.
So could you share with us a success story, someone that came to you for coaching and where they were and where they ended up?
Well, it's interesting, you know, like I do a lot of relationship coaching and, you know, people come to me right before they're about to get divorced, right? And I haven't had a couple get divorced yet, which is the good news, you know, but it's not just about not getting divorced. Like, you know, it's interesting. You get together with somebody in a relationship and emotionally something happens where you don't necessarily mature emotionally as much as somebody who's single, right? That's just always been my experience, right? And so you use the level of skill with that partner that you had when you got together with them, but to increase your skills while you're in the relationship doesn't usually happen until the wheels are falling off, right? And so, you know, a lot of the times when people come to me, like they've been together for 20 years, 30 years, whatever it is, 10 years, who knows, and the wheels are falling off. And it's like, they're still have the expectations and they still have the skills that they got when they got together with this person, but nothing changed. And so, you know, working with people on how do you have a different level of skill and a different level of, you know, emotional reasoning much later down the line is mostly what I work with people on. And so I have this one couple who, oh my God, they were so ready to get divorced. And they were literally like wanting me to, in the beginning, to negotiate the terms of their divorce. and I said, okay, well, we can start there, right? And we did. We started talking about the terms of their divorce. And I would ask them over and over again, you know, if this could be different, what would that look like? If this could be different, what would that look like? And, you know, 3 years later, they're still together. They still come to coaching, you know, every other week or so. And they've learned how to talk to each other in a totally different manner. But they've also learned how to accept each other at this different place in life. Like, they both came to the conversation expecting that person to be the way they were when they met him 30 years ago. And that's just not what happens in relationships. You grow and you change and you become a different person. And sometimes it's really easy to get focused on what the other person isn't doing to avoid dealing with you not being who you think you should be, you know? And that's most of the time, for me, what I've realized it is. When somebody is so focused on what the other person is doing or isn't doing, or, you know, how they've hurt me or why they're a victim of them. If I said, you know, if you could take them completely out of the equation, what would you be dealing with that you, you know, that would have nothing to do with them? All of a sudden they have a different view on life and they see things in a completely different way and they become their own individual. And they get to a place where they're like, oh, it's not about, you know, making that person be who I want them to be or getting them to behave who I want them to behave as, but it's about me being who I'm supposed to be and letting them have the journey that they're supposed to have. And, you know, that's a hard concept for a lot of people in relationships, especially if they've been together for a really long time.
That's interesting. I've noticed with every single coach that I've talked to on this podcast that it all comes back to identity and finding who you truly are and then living as that person instead of what other people want you to be or what society wants you to be. So I coach people who are not long out of a long-term relationship. And that's what I found with myself when I came out of a 13-year relationship and what I find with my clients as well, that's they had a couple identity and now they have to find their own identity. But yeah, no matter what kind of coach I've been talking to, we all seem to be identity coaches.
Totally. I mean, because that's truthfully, I mean, look, there's nothing we can do about anybody else. But and that's been my philosophy forever, which is, you know, if I change me, the world around me changes, you know? And, you know, I spent years trying to get people around me to be different. And, you know, it just made me angry and frustrated and really awful to be around, you know? And when I realized that, you know, the only person that I can, you know, change anything about is me, you know, life got a whole lot easier. That's for sure.
If you had to boil your coaching down to a core philosophy, would that be it? How would you put that?
My core philosophy has to do with, you know, nobody else has to change for me to be happy. That's really what it is. And so, yeah, technically that's really what it is. Like, if nobody else has to change for me to be happy, what do I have to do to make myself happy? Right. And, you know, without stepping on the toes of somebody else, you know, my husband doesn't always like the fact that I have to do the things for my life that I do in order to be happy, because it takes time away from him. But at the same time, he wouldn't want me to be any different than who I am, right? And if he needed, you know, when he gets into a place where he's super needy of me and my time, it's usually because he's avoiding dealing with something with himself. And that's been the case every time we've come up against that. It's like, okay, well, if you didn't have me to focus on and you didn't have me to be the reason all your problems are happening, you know, what would you be focusing on? What would you do differently? You know? And then it's amazing. Like, all of a sudden he starts to look at those things and, you know, we end up being in a much better place because he's dealing with him, I'm dealing with me, and we get to be just together. We don't need to make each other whole by sacrificing ourselves for the other person. Not that sacrifice isn't a relationship, it is, but it's not, it shouldn't be to the point of, you know, it being destructive to one person or the other.
Yeah, it sounds to me like the sacrifice is letting go of your needs from the other person when they need something else. It's all about each of you meeting your own needs and then coming together.
Yeah, I mean, it's coming, when I have a need from him, you know, it has to do with, you know, most of the time for me anyway, it has to do with, I want you to be the best person that you can be so that we can have a great life together, right? Because when he's on his game and I'm on my game, you know, nothing can touch us, right? But when he's not on his game and wants me to make up for where he's not on his game, that's when it becomes a problem. right? Like that's just codependency.
Yeah, that's right. Often when people come to me after they've just come out of a long-term relationship, they're looking to jump into a new relationship to make them happy. And and the first thing I have to teach them is that you don't need someone else to make you happy. You don't need the right partner to make you happy. You need to be happy to find the right partner.
100%. 100%. And that's, you know, a lot of the people that I work with are doing dating stuff and love relationship stuff. Like, that's what we talk about. It's like, you know, I always have them draw a picture of exactly, you know, what does your partner look like? What is the perfect partner look like for you? You know, and then they write down all of the things that are important to them. And then I say, are you that person? Are you that person that you think is a perfect ideal? Because if you're not, you're not going to attract it. Right? Like you have to.
No, you're going to attract someone else with the same sorts of problems that you have is what you're going to attract. And then exactly. It's going to multiply.
Yes. Especially if you have children. So, you know, like, and that's so the truth, like water seeks its own level, right? Like water can't go higher than water, where water is supposed to go, where other water is, right? So, so water will always seek its own level. And it's and energy is the same way. Like, you know, if my energy is off, you know, then I'm going to attract people who are off in that way.
And the great thing about it is, even though it increases your chances of getting together with the right partner, when you become whole and happy in yourself as an individual, it doesn't actually matter if you do find them, because you're already happy and whole yourself as an individual. So it's a bit not fair. The people who need partners the least are the ones that find the right partners.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's what it sounds like, right? So for sure. But at the same time, it is that way. It's, you know, when I'm and you always hear people say it, like, when I'm not looking, I wasn't even looking for him and he walked in the door. Yeah. And now we've been together for the rest. Well, why weren't you looking? Because you were happy, because you were enjoying your life, because you were being who you were supposed to be. You know, it's kind of the funny part about the dating apps. It's like, you know, everybody on there is desperate to find somebody, even if it's just for 5 minutes. So it's already working against itself in some way.
Yeah. So what's one piece of wisdom, Quincy, that you consistently find yourself giving to anyone who will listen, or just comes out in conversation all the time?
Oh, God, I don't know. I mean, that's, you know, there's a lot of different things. You know, it depends on the week. Like, I realized, like, there's, you know, like, during the, depending on what week it is, like, I will talk to different people, and it'll seem like they're all having the same problem in the same week, you know? And so I end up saying the same thing over and over again. And I think a lot of, you know, what I'm hearing about right now has to do with, you know, people feeling, you know, everybody I've talked to is people feeling like they just can't get out of their own way, right? Like they can't seem to get to that next place, right? And so a lot of the things, you know, I say to people a lot is, you know, do you know where your next place is? And they're like, well, no. And I said, well, if you don't have any idea of where your place is, how are you going to know that that's, you know, how do you know that that's what it is you're supposed to do? Right. And so getting people just to be willing to look at themselves and look at, you know, what do they wish they could do differently right now has been something that I talk about a lot. And it's a question I ask people all the time. What do you wish you could do differently? Whether it's a conversation you had with somebody or something you did at work or a decision you made about, you know, the path that you're on. What do you wish you could do differently? Right. And a lot of the times that answer will really, you know, propel them into the next level of whatever it is they're supposed to look at. You know, I have a friend, this came up last week. I have a friend of mine who, you know, he's you know, out there dating again. And he goes, I keep dating the same person over and over again. They're always emotionally unavailable. They always, you know, don't really want to be in a relationship. They just want somebody to hang out with and be a buddy with, but they don't really want to give anything. And I said, okay. And I said, and he said, and if I don't find them, then I find the other ones, the ones that are super needy and super emotionally available and, you know, like want to choke me with how much emotion they have. And I said, well, do you know what it is that you're looking for? And he said, no. I said, do you know how to recognize these people when they're coming at you? He said, I guess not. And I said, do this. I said, go write down the top five things all of the last, you know, couple of girls that you dated had in common and tell me what they are, right? And it was funny because I saw him the next day and he said, I can't even believe how much just being aware of what those five things were in all those people, like how much awareness that gave me. And I said, that's great. And I said, but the opposite, you know, the opposite is true as well. Like if you don't know what you're looking for, you're not going to find it. Right. And I said, so you've got to get clear on what it is that's important to you and what it is that you're looking for so that you can find it. Right. Even, you know, whether it's jobs, whether it's friendships, whether it's dating, whether it's a house, you know what I mean? Whatever it is. Like if you don't know what it is that's important to you and what you're looking for, you will not find it.
If you don't know what it is that you're looking for, you will not find it. Well, there's a bit of a wisdom right there.
Exactly. I mean, that's, you know, and that's, you know, it sounds really simple or sounds corny,
yeah.
But you know, it's really, I mean, it is really that simple.
I'm sure he would have thought it sounded simple before he wrote those five things down. And then, but seeing it in action is a whole different thing from, you know, hearing it and going, oh yeah, that's obvious. Yep.
Yep. Well, and so, that's the thing. I mean, when people put stuff on paper, it makes stuff really clear, you know?
Yeah.
To do it in your brain, it just picks up steam and, you know, it doesn't ever get resolved on some level.
Yeah. Well, but, putting it on paper or having it in a conversation with a coach, for example. Yeah. Really, because the right questions get asked, it doesn't just bounce around and it becomes clear.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because I don't know about you, but I wake up in the middle of the night often. Right. And I can solve all of the world's problems between 2 a.m. and like 5 a.m. I do some of my greatest thinking in the middle of the night. And it's funny because if I get up and I write down what I'm thinking about, it's not nearly as much stuff as I think I'm thinking. Right? Like it's really just a couple of key thoughts, but in my brain, it feels so much bigger and so much more important and so much more developed because it just picks up steam as it's in there. Right. But then you go to put it on paper and, you know, it gets boiled down to maybe a couple of things. Right. And, you know, and that's always been the case for me is that the second I put it on paper, not only does it take, you know, the emotion or the grandiosity out of whatever it is, hey, that I'm thinking about, right? Hey, shh, I have a 4-pound dog who thinks she's the boss of me. But
there's a dog barking here as well.
Oh wow. Well good. They're all barking together. But it does it takes away the emotion and the grandiosity of the situation, right? And all of a sudden it feels manageable, right? It feels
yeah.
like something you can deal with. And you know, that's you know, one of the biggest problems, I think, with the mental health crisis right now is that everybody is so falling for whatever it is that their brain is telling them. And, you know, learning how to separate who you are from what your brain does for a living, I like to say, you know, is probably one of the most important skills anybody can teach anybody.
And I just heard another little, I guess this is a technique or a bit of wisdom or whatever else it is, mm-hmm. but you have a problem, write it down.
For sure. Write it down.
Write
it down. And if you still have that problem, then figure out what it is about that problem that's going on. Because a lot of the time it just doesn't mean much. You know, our brain is designed to think. That's what it's supposed to do. But just because it's having thoughts doesn't mean that those thoughts are true or need to be paid attention to. But if you
or are as big as they feel
yes.
in your head.
Exactly. But if
and
you
then, yeah, wait, figure out a way to deal with it. That is
yep.
how you deal with it. Not how somebody, not how if somebody else would change something, then it would be dealt with. But what
exactly.
can you do?
Yeah. And that's, you know,
excellent.
That's, yeah. That's this dog, 4-pound dog, 4-pound dog who thinks she's 100 pounds.
It's so funny. Yeah. Dogs are so funny how they if it's a small dog, it will attack big dogs and think it's a big dog. And if it's a big dog, it'll try to sit in your lap like it's a little dog. They just don't know their size.
They don't know their size. They don't know time. They don't know a lot of things. They just keep going. They just keep going, little girl.
So what's the real end result that your clients get from working with you?
You know, feeling empowered, feeling like, you know, no matter what comes at them, they can deal with that. You know, that problems aren't necessarily the end of the game. They're the beginning, right? And they're really, you know, things are just about teaching us how to develop our skills. Like whenever a problem is, if it's a problem, what did my friend used to say? If it's a problem, then there's an answer, right? There's a solution to it. But if there's not a solution to the problem, then it's just a fact. And learning how to differentiate between the two is, you know, not always easy. But every time there's a problem that shows up in your life, it's not game over. It's, you know, what do I have to do to solve this problem? You know, and helping people see that, you know, problems are gifts in disguise most of the time.
Well, our brains want, humans are problem solving machines. I've noticed that sometimes when I'm like, you know, I'm feeling unsettled, like there's a, but I don't know what the problem is or whatever. Sometimes I'll sit down and play a game or something, like a board game. And it turns out my brain just needed a problem to solve. It didn't have a problem. And make something up. But just play a game, solve game problem. Yes. You don't actually need a real problem to solve. Your brain wants something to solve.
Just wants something to do.
Yeah. So is there... These last two questions are just designed to catch anything that we could have caught in this conversation that we haven't yet. So it's okay if the answer is no, and we've already covered everything. And it's also great if there is an answer to these. So first one is there anything that we were discussing that you didn't get to say as much as you wanted to because we did go off on a tangent or headed off in a different direction?
No, I think I was pretty succinct on most of it.
And is there anything that I didn't even know to bring up, Quincy, that would be a glaring omission in a survey of the life and work of Quincy?
No. My phone just all of a sudden started ringing. No. I mean, I think you got a pretty good overview of what it is that I do and what it's like being with me as a coach.
Excellent.
Yep.
Great. Well, the point of this podcast is it's for anyone who wants to listen and glean anything they can on self-development from hearing chats with all different kinds of coaches. Mm-hmm. But it's also for people who are ready for a coach and hear the person that they need in their life to contact them to get started. So for those listeners today who are saying, I need Quincy Wharf in my life to help me move forward, how do they find you?
They can go to quincywharf.com and they can get a hold of me there. And yeah, and I have all kinds of contact information on there and all kinds of other stuff that they can reach out to.
So if they're old people like us, they can email you. If they're even older than us, they can fax you. No, probably not. And if they're young people, they can reach out by Messenger or TikTok.
There's only one Quincy Wharf that I know of. So I am on TikTok and Facebook.
Oh, yeah. Can you spell that out for us, please?
Sure. QUINCYWHORF. As in Frank.
Is that the same way Worf on Star Trek spells his name, or is it?
Nope, he's W-O-R-F.
Okay, so yep. Quincy is W-H-O-R-F.
Yes.
Fantastic. And if you need to find me, you can find me anytime at jeremywest.net. And that also lists, there's also a link there to every episode of this podcast. Thank you so much, Quincy, for coming, and we'll see you again soon.
Thanks so much, Jeremy. I appreciate it. Take care.
Bye-bye.